Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, we're hearing in person from one of today's winners of the Nobel Prize for Economics. We're in Egypt, where politicians are enraged by a new Nile River deal, which they say deprives them of water and an economic future. And remembering Lilly Ledbetter, the trailblazer for equal pay who's just died.
She experienced what a lot of women across this country and across the world do, and that is pay discrimination. And she has become an icon fighting that discrimination in the courts, through the Congress, and she's cherished by our community.
Well, now to China, where arguably the biggest story of the day has been what isn't happening there. Speaking at a press conference on Saturday, a couple of days ago, the Chinese finance minister, Lan Fuan, reaffirmed Beijing's commitment to a long-expected economic stimulus measure. But he stopped short of saying what exactly these measures would be.
Since the beginning of this year, the fiscal department faithfully implemented the decisions of the Central Conference on Economic Work. As a next step, we will increase our support and scholarships to students and increase the overall consumption capacity.
The words there, or some of them, of the Chinese finance minister speaking through a translator. Well, China's stocks have risen on Monday on the back of these comments, but there was a significant 2% price drop in the oil market as OPEC lowered its expectations of future global oil demand. Joining me to discuss that is the managing director, is Amrita Sen, I beg your pardon. She's the founder and director of research at Energy Aspects, a global research house which advises companies on energy markets. Amrita, this downward revision from OPEC, dropping the oil price, that is driven specifically by expectations around China, right?
Yes, very much so. I think the Chinese... the Chinese economy has been struggling all year. We've seen a huge decline in diesel demand as well. And this is the first time outside of COVID that we think oil demand is going to be down year on year.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? At a time of upheaval in the Middle East, the risk of war involving Iran, perhaps a major oil producer. You'd think that those things would be driving sentiment more than anything. And yet here we have China, of course, the world's largest crude oil importer, driving sentiment in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I think the challenge we have in this market is that the market's been really badly burned, kind of betting on geopolitics, and that we're going to lose supplies. And that's why it consistently, since really the Russia-Ukraine war and also the 2019 attacks on Upcake in Saudi Arabia, it's been kind of fading any geopolitical headlines. And I'm sure you've seen just over the last few minutes, there's been some media headlines suggesting that, you know, Israel's not going to strike Iranian oil facilities. And we've had a massive sell-off in oil prices, right? I think that's the issue. And this is exactly why, unless and until you get a real supply outage, the focus will remain on demand.
So it's a very twitchy reaction from the oil markets. Back to China, though, and how it consumes oil. I suppose there will be those saying, you know, I suppose car drivers in China. I mean, it's all electric there in China now, isn't it? There is a big switch going on. Does that dent the import of fuel much, or is oil being consumed elsewhere in China?
So 50% of Chinese car sales are electric cars, but even then, gasoline demand has continued to grow in China. And the reason for that is those electric cars, while it, you know, the media will focus on that, that's not the fleet. The fleet is still mainly gasoline, and turning over the fleet bare minimum takes 12 years. Also, I think it's important to remember their electric car metrics actually include hybrids. Hybrids, of course, are effectively a very efficient gasoline car, right? Especially once you're out of a city. So the challenge isn't as much on the car side. The challenge has been much more on the trucking side. We've seen more LNG penetration on trucking, and generally the economy being very weak just has meant that you just don't have enough construction and the boost to oil demand that comes from that.
Okay, Dr. Amrit Sen, thank you very much indeed. So joining me now is Shehzad Qazi. He's Managing Director at the China Beige Book, which monitors the data around China's economy, more than just oil consumption, I guess. Shehzad, first of all, I mean, remind us, we had these stumbling indicators, of course, for many months. We've had a crashing share price in Shanghai. Then we had this promise of stimulus, didn't we, in late September, several weeks ago. That saw a record surge in stock prices in China. So what was the nature of the original promise from Beijing about stimulus? What are we waiting for?
You know, I think what's happened here is that Chinese policymakers have rolled out some stimulus vows, but they're really focused on putting a floor under sentiment of markets and, more importantly, putting a floor under growth. They were not intended to be the type of big bang bazooka stimulus, I think, that a lot of the folks in the stock markets confused them with, which I think explains by and large the rally that we got and some of the disappointment since. The fact of the matter is we're actually waiting on details to figure out exactly what constitutes spending this year and next year and what the nature of the stimulus will actually look like and how much of it is stimulus rather than things like just recapitalizing the banks or bailing out local governments to an extent or doing debt swaps and so forth.
Yeah. Some would say, you know, moving deck chairs on the Titanic, wouldn't they? I mean, it's a kind of, that's probably an extreme comment, but the point is here that China has long been very constrained because of this massive debt pile it's facing. It cannot, perhaps, arguably, do as much as the, you know, the more bullish characters on the stock market would hope it could. That big bazooka you referred to, it just can't do it because the debt is already starting to look unsustainable to some people.
The only way for them to really do a big bazooka at this point and stimulate the economy is either through a wholesale rescue of the property market, which in effect would mean bailing out Chinese developers, which we know that from President Xi downward, there's absolutely no desire to do that. Or in addition to that, it would be a massive household-focused stimulus, including beginning with transfers of cash or spending vouchers and so forth, so that Chinese consumers could go out there and spend the money. And we've also seen so far that there hasn't been any news of that. And we know that there is an ideological opposition, again, especially with Secretary Xi calling, you know, saying he's opposed to things like welfareism. So that, I think those two options are not really in play, which takes out the kind of big bazooka style stimulus that a lot of the Western observers were thinking would come out of China. I think what you're getting instead is, quite frankly, a lot more appropriate for the Chinese economy, which is very targeted, sustained amounts of spending that is going to take place without, I think, creating bigger risks within the economy.
Right. So it's going to be a very gentle kind of massaging down, perhaps, not just of these growth expectations, but the economy more generally. And yet there are people, I saw one quoted in the press today saying, you know, we're still waiting. There'll be this National People's Congress session in December. This is one of the big events of the calendar. More decisions on stimulus could yet happen. Do you expect volatility in the terms of the reaction of people, or are people just gradually just adjusting to a kind of Japanese-style deflationary situation?
I think if we're talking about markets such as the commodities markets or the equities markets, I think we're probably going to get a little bit of volatility ahead. I think you know, there's a good chance that we see a continuation of the current rally, but that as we get into 2025 and investors start to realize that, A, that the benefits to the real economy of the kind of stimulus that Chinese policymakers are planning to undertake and roll out, the benefits to the real economy are not nearly as large as were initially presumed, or perhaps some of the benefits, such as the boost to some of the retail spending, some of the boost to the property sales, eventually begin petering out, and then you get sort of a more ugly reversal in sentiment as well. So that's also a risk that we're looking out for. As we think about sort of how markets are going to react and respond to the various stimulus plays.
Shehzad Kazi of the China Page Book, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Well, let's switch focus to the US now. The markets there. Peter Jankowskis, Vice President, Research and Analysis at Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. Hi, Peter. The S&P, meanwhile, was having a good day, wasn't it? Notched another record on Monday.
Yes, indeed. The S&P overall was up about 0.8%. Technology shares really led the way. The technology sector was up 1.4%. The only sector that did not gain on the day was energy, and that's not surprising given that oil stocks came down, or oil prices came down.
Yeah, the fall in the oil price. I mean, just talk us through that. Presumably that's kind of good news for everyone looking at the Fed and what its next decision is, because that will perhaps depress a little bit soon the gas price, and that'll affect inflation numbers.
Well, it could help out the Fed a little bit, though they tend to focus more on the core price increases, and energy is typically taken out of that. But certainly energy prices going down isn't going to hurt.
Okay. So tech, Nvidia, that was one of the big stories of the day.
Yes, NVIDIA was up 2.4% on the day. I think investors are looking forward to another strong earnings report when it comes out next month.
Are we bullish still about this progress then towards the next Fed rate cut, or is there a more nuanced view about what's going to happen next?
I think it is more nuanced now. Some of the economic reports have been fairly strong, and inflation reports, while still continuing a downward trend in inflation, that trend has slowed somewhat. So I think there are people pulling back on the very bullish thoughts that the Fed might cut rates another 0.5%. I think more people are thinking now in terms of 0.25%.
Peter Jankowskis, thank you.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. A multinational agreement on managing the waters of the Nile River has come into force, despite being strongly opposed by both Egypt and Sudan. After more than a decade of negotiations, the Nile River Basin Cooperative Framework Agreement, to give it its full name, is meant to rectify historical imbalances to ensure upstream and downstream countries can benefit from the Nile's waters. Well, Ethiopia's decision to build a vast hydroelectric dam has fueled a major row and a lot of the problems. Egypt, to a lesser degree Sudan, fear it's going to impact their water supply a great deal. Yom Yahamaki is a professor of economics at Ain Shams University in Egypt.
What happened regarding Antibi that you are asking about is that Egypt refused such agreement, and it's not, and Ethiopia has signed with other partners such agreement in order to specify the amount of water that should be dedicated to Egypt. This is actually against international laws. Okay? And from here it comes that Egypt is against such agreement, because this is agreement is based on exclusion of some countries that refuse this agreement.
So basically the countries like Ethiopia, of course, and also Rwanda, South Sudan, Uganda and others, the ones that are upstream from you in the Nile, at the far end of the Nile, so to speak, they are, you're saying, claiming too much of the water resources from the river and depriving it of you. What have you seen in recent years as the claims on the water have become more intense from those upstream countries?
Yes, because Egypt nowadays is suffering from poverty of water. And Egypt spent more than 400 billion Egyptian pound in order to try to enhance the potential of water by recycling, by desalination, all other mega project in order to address water scarcity and water poverty. And at the same time, you know that, as Harold did mention, Egypt is a gift of the Nile. So when you deprive Egypt from a part, an important part of water against international laws, this will have a very negative impact on the economy, the security of people, because we are more than 100 in population.
100 million people, you mean?
Yes, and food security is becoming a big challenge.
And what will Egypt do? Given that this deal, this agreement has been imposed
Egypt
on you, what will happen?
Egypt is always trying to find solutions by agreement, always trying to explain the repercussions, to refer to technicians and experts to explain what are the repercussions of what Ethiopia is doing without any results.
That's the Egyptian economist Yom El-Hamaki. The Nobel Prize in Economics has just been announced. It's gone to three academics who have devoted their careers to trying to explain why some nations are rich and others are poor. The countries with inclusive institutions, they say, with widespread political participation, those tend to be richer. Conversely, societies with smaller elite groups tend to be less well off. James Robinson is one of those three winners.
The reason countries flourish or fail economically is to do with the way that, you know, human beings themselves organize the society, you know, create what we call, you know, in social science, institutions, rules that create patterns of incentives and opportunities that allow people to flourish and innovate or block them. And, you know, that's a political process. And it's a process that worked out in very different ways in different parts of the world. You know, for example, you know, today in the United States is Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day. And that's it's a very appropriate day to be getting this prize, because part of our research has been showing, you know, the devastating role of European colonialism in creating so much of the poverty in the modern world.
So the institutions, that is perhaps law courts or educational institutions or what, healthcare institutions, I mean, describe how it is that these have varied, particularly with the legacy of colonialism, as you say, which has, of course, dominated so many parts of the world.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the most fundamental thing you could think about would be having a kind of rule of law that applied to everybody. Think about apartheid South Africa. You know, why is apartheid South Africa the way it is? Well, that was a society where white people organized it to exploit black people. They pushed black people into Bantustans. They created laws, passed laws, you know, to keep wages down, to exploit black labor. White people lived at the same standard of living as in Britain, and black people were impoverished. So there's an example of, like, what we call extractive institutions, of how the society was organized for the benefit of some people at the expense of others. And that's basically the same story wherever you go: North Korea, Guatemala, That's why countries are poor. And, you know, to become prosperous, you have to break out of that kind of extractive society and build more inclusive institutions so that all your talent and potential can come out.
The Nobel Prize winner, Professor James Robinson. And you can hear a fuller version of my interview with Professor Robinson in Business Matters from Midnight GMT. Now, on a similar theme, the World Bank has just released a report focusing on the 26 poorest countries around the world. It paints a sobering picture of the challenges they are facing. Countries like Afghanistan, North Korea, Somalia and Zimbabwe. The challenges include widespread poverty, limited access to healthcare and education, and an ever greater exclusion from the global financial system. I spoke with Ayhan Kossi about this, the World Bank's deputy chief economist who oversaw the report.
Half of these low-income countries are now in debt distress, or they are about to fall into debt distress. This is the worst what we have seen for nearly two decades, if you look at debt.
This is, I suppose, symptomatic of the fact that certain countries, I mean, when you look at people like the Afghans, Somalia, Sudan, that they, to some extent, or in different cases, many of them have sort of found themselves effectively cut off from the global economic system in many ways, haven't they, for different reasons. And they are now also facing a sharp reduction in a lot of Western or international aid programs.
Yes, there are domestic reasons. As you mentioned, some of these countries are in conflict, they are quite fragile. And of course, we had a number of, you know, shocks over the past 4 years, starting with the pandemic, the multiple wars in multiple regions. And then you have this sharp decline in development aid. And all of these hit these economies at the same time.
What does that do to their access to credit?
They don't have much of access to credit. When they have, the credit is, you know, very, very expensive. And because of that, they are allocating their spending increasingly on interest payments, on debt. So they are trying to pay back debt. Because of that, they are unable to allocate, you know, money for health and education, and that's very critical in these countries with very, very low income levels.
Are you basically saying these are people who, you know, these are nations that have just sort of dropped off the radar?
I think it's fair to say that at the worst moment, global communities' interest in these economies is at the level it should be. But it is critical for the global community, you know, provide the necessary financing. If we do not help these countries now, the cost of repair will be even larger down the road.
Can the World Bank be in this position in a sustainable way?
When you look at what we have done, we provided nearly half of all development aid to these economies in 2022. This is the last year we have data. We would like to have more people come to the table. We have a you know, campaign. We are in the middle of it, trying to raise resources for these economies. We are hoping that more countries, richer countries, donor countries, come to table and then, you know, contribute to financing we are providing.
A warning to the world there from the World Bank's Ayhan Kossi. This weekend saw the death of Lilly Ledbetter at the age of 86. Miss Ledbetter had been hailed as a trailblazer in the fight for equal pay in the US. Her one-woman lawsuit against her employer paved the way for the Fair Pay Act of 2009. Miss Ledbetter, who got a job at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in Gadsden, Alabama, back in 1979, found that her pay had dropped out of line with her male colleagues a couple of decades later. She spoke about what happened next at a summit 3 years ago.
1998, I filed a charge with the Equal Employment Commission, even though I was 2 years away from retirement. 1999, I filed a lawsuit. 2003, my case was heard in a federal court in Alabama. A jury came back and awarded me $3.8 million. It was proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that I had been unequally paid for equal work.
But even then, the story did not end there, as I found out when I spoke about Lily Ledbetter's story with Noreen Farrell. She's the executive director of the Equal Rights Advocates organization based in San Francisco. She knew Lily personally.
Yeah, Lily never set out to be a trailblazer. She was a worker at a tire company in Alabama for 19 years. But she experienced what a lot of women across this country and across the world do, and that is pay discrimination. And she has become an icon fighting that discrimination in the courts, through the Congress, she's cherished by our community.
Yeah, she found through an anonymous source, it seems, that she was not getting paid the same as men alongside her. And she took that to her employer. It took her years, didn't it? And it went all the way to the Supreme Court eventually.
It did. In fact, she didn't really learn about the pay discrimination until decades into her workplace, as you said, through an anonymous note. She filed her lawsuit in 1999. She won, but then her case was overturned. It went to the Supreme Court, and it found that she hadn't filed her case in time, because at that time, the law was that you have to file within 180 days of your first discriminatory paycheck, which really doesn't make a lot of sense when most people don't know that they're being discriminated against. And so President Obama signed the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act to make sure that didn't happen to other women.
Yeah, she gave her name to that case. As you say, it seems a little extraordinary, perhaps in the U.S., where there's been pretty advanced legislation on things like racial discrimination, that a woman would be discriminated against and could be with very little right of redress because of these strange loopholes.
You're exactly that. It's not only that people have to deal with pay discrimination and pay secrecy, but then the law up until that point really worked against them to be able to really seek redress in the courts. But President Obama changed that, signing this as his first law when he was in office, and it's really helped millions of women across the country since.
As you say, she's a trailblazer. What kind of a person was she? What kind of a figurehead?
Lily was a shero in that she was a regular person. She was warm. She was engaging. She showed up for every event you needed her at decades after her first legal case. She was inspiring. She was an every woman, and she really just wanted to be treated fairly in the workplace. And knowing that that couldn't happen for herself, she made it her legacy to make sure it happened for others.
How much has this law changed things for women?
There are millions of women and other people who experience pay discrimination who have benefited from Lily Ledbetter and this law. You know, we still have a ways to go to make sure that women are paid equally for equal work. But it's laws like this and women like Lily that have made the difference and will continue to do so in the years to come.
Noreen Farrell. And among the other tributes pouring in today for Lily Ledbetter, Presidents Obama and Biden have spoken. Joe Biden said today that Lily Ledbetter never stopped fighting for all Americans to be paid what they deserve. And that's it for this edition of World Business Report. I'm Ed Butler. Thanks very much for listening.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.